You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, September the 14th, and it's time for The Week in Review. Every Friday at this time, we welcome in two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the news of the week. And today is no exception. We have two legal experts with us today. Ann Althaus, a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, currently a visiting professor of law at the Brooklyn Law School. She joins us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us on the telephone, Peg Lautenschlager, attorney with Lawton & Cates, former attorney general of Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, Ann.
Hi, Peg.
This will be an interesting, this is the first time you two have been paired up for the Week in Review.
True.
Looking forward to that. And let me give numbers. If you have an issue from the news this week that you would like to discuss, call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. You can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Well, let's start with President Bush's address to the nation last night, where he said, among other things, this.
General Petraeus believes we have now reached the point where we can maintain our security gains with fewer American forces. He has recommended that we not replace about 2,200 Marines scheduled to leave Anbar Province later this month. In addition, he says it will soon be possible to bring home an Army Combat Brigade for a total force reduction of 5,700 troops by Christmas.
So 5,700 troops by Christmas, more gradual withdrawals through next year, so that by July, the overall troop level in Iraq could be down to about 130,000, which is close to where it was before the president ordered the surge last winter. Democrats are saying that this planned troop reduction is not enough. What do you say, Ann Althaus?
Well, I think it'd be hard to wrangle with the president about how much to reduce the troops when he's got the general who's there fighting the war making that recommendation. I think it kind of changes with the political dynamic, you know, in Congress. But the real question is whether people will put up with seeing it as a political wrangle in Congress when, you know, we really seriously are trying to fight the war. And the president does seem to be responding to some extent to people who want to see things start to end. And I think it's important that he's defining things in terms of success. You know, he's not saying, you know, we'll just fight forever, we'll win, but that we will bring people home as they're successful and look, they're being successful. I think that is somewhat appealing if people have any ability to listen to it at all. I mean, I watched the speech last night and I thought, you know, I read it on paper this morning. It read a lot better on paper than he presented it. He just isn't very good at looking people in the eye and saying what he has to say and convincing people. So I don't know if people will hear the substance at all.
Do you think, Peg Lautenschlager, that he convinced anybody?
Well, he certainly didn't convince me, and I think he didn't convince a lot of midstream America. I did not read the speech on paper, and so I don't know if it looks better than it sounded to me last night. But my concern was that it was such a gimmicky kind of speech, and I think we see that in politics so much these days. And essentially, you have a president who I don't think had a grasp on exactly what he's doing there, why he went into the war. There was an implicit admission that this is all about oil and energy resources in some ways. You know, this notion that we are going to fight a country so that we can eliminate terrorism, and that ending portion where he essentially creates yet another domino theory by essentially saying, if we don't do this in Iraq, before you know it, more buildings will be blown up in the United States, is really troubling to me. You know, if we follow that philosophy and we are going to go into every nation in which al-Qaeda is active, we might as well move into all of Africa, a good portion of the Mideast, and a variety of other places around the world. I just didn't see any clear direction. I didn't see any clear end game. I didn't see any clear purpose other than perhaps that underlying one which nobody wants to talk about, which is moneyed interests and oil interests here, you know, wanting to ensure that we have control of a lot of wells in the Mideast.
Yeah, Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island delivered the Democratic response to the president's address, and he said the president failed to provide either a plan to successfully end the war or a convincing rationale to continue it. And he said Democrats would work profoundly to change the U.S. military involvement in Iraq. I'm wondering, Ann Althaus, what you think of the Democratic response.
Well, I thought Reid also seemed to be sleepwalking through his speech. I mean, I don't know why they... I think they picked Reid because he has a military background, mm-hmm. but he's a rather dull personality, and I don't think he provided much vigor to the Democratic side, and I think there is some confusion on that side about how really to distinguish themselves, you know, once Petraeus has made his presentation and there is some success. And, you know, people would, I think, rather see success than losing. The idea that we should declare defeat and pull out is not appealing to people. And I think Bush's alternative is at least better than that. But I don't think many people paid much attention to Reid. I mean, on my TV, I checked it out on two different channels. There was an electronic buzz in the background, and I just couldn't focus on what he was saying at all. But, you know, he's not exactly a charismatic character. I don't know why they didn't, I don't think they were particularly trying to make much of a response to Bush last night.
Mm-hmm. Peg Lautenschlager?
Well, first of all, I think I don't want to get into a big discussion on whether or not one must be charismatic in order to appeal to the American public. I would think bright, articulate, and a bunch of other things like that ought to come first, but apparently our society is devolved in a way that charisma or something that trips one's trigger that's a little sexier or something is more important. But that being said, I think Harry Reid has essentially, though, outlined... Jack Reid has outlined, though, what is a very down-to-earth kind of commonsensical thing. I think the criticism against Democrats has always been that, oh, it's easy to talk about pulling out the troops, but how are we doing this in a logical way? Here you have someone with military experience, albeit he not necessarily charismatic as such, but who really did a serious analysis as opposed to coming up with buzzwords and buzz phrases as to how we ought to proceed in something. I don't think this was talking about loss, but talking about purpose, talking about when do we lose American lives, that kind of thing. And in that way, Congressman Reid, I think, did a good job in terms of talking, articulating that point of view.
Yeah. Let's take a couple of calls on this. Dave in Wanakee is first. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if either of your guests saw the 2-minute ad that John Edwards purchased for after the speech, but I thought in his 2 minutes he was much more eloquent than the president, saying that the war has gone on for too long, that we're following a failed policy, and that Congress needs to give an ultimatum to the president: no timeline, no funding, no excuses.
Mm-hmm. I did not see the ad. Did either of you?
Well, I didn't. I'll look at it on YouTube today, and I'll probably blog about it and put the clip up on my ad. I'm sorry I didn't watch that. I'm sure that he was more, speaking of charisma, I'm sure Edwards was much more charismatic than Reid and is much more able to present an opposing viewpoint. But the man is running for president, and the danger there is that fighting a war seems to be more about the presidential election than about things apart from the presidential election, and that's a very dangerous perspective to present. And of course, I mean, obviously Edwards knows he has that problem, to speak sincerely about it as opposed to speaking self-interestedly about it. It's hard to do. It's hard to convince people about it. Of course, the same is true of Bush. They're all doing that. It's very alarming to me that, we're trying to fight a war, but this presidential election is there in the background really dominating everything, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I think essentially what has happened, though, is that the issue of the war is dominating the presidential election, and it is because it's such an essential one to the democracy. I think citizens have a right to say, hey, George Bush, we don't agree with you. And, whether or not Edwards is more charismatic or not, I think, he's an articulate man, he's a thoughtful man, he's a bright man, he's certainly a very bright man. And his using his opposition to the current trend in Iraq is something which ought to be discussed. Just because it's a war doesn't mean it shouldn't be subject to discussion within the democracy, and I think that's the tragedy here. We've seen this with terrorism, we've seen this with this war, we've seen this throughout the Bush administration, that somehow questioning our nation's policies, which ought to be a fundamental precept of this democracy, is something which is being construed as a questioning of one's patriotism or somehow using politics in its worst form to, in its worst interpretation, to define, you know, how we fight wars, that somehow wars should be above politics. You know, tragically in this country, I think the place we ought to be concerned about politics entering into the picture is in the judiciary, in the judicial branch of our government, where, you know, theoretically at least that sort of politics wouldn't exist, but certainly in the executive branch. We have always had a notion that, you know, there would be no one person so powerful as to rise above the will of the citizens.
Let me just stick to the claim that John Edwards made in that ad last night. I have here that he said, Congress has the power to end the war by withholding funding that isn't contingent on a timeline for withdrawal. Now, while Congress may have that power, Peg Lautenschlager, does the Senate, do Democrats have the votes to do that?
Well, Democrats certainly don't have the votes today. They have the votes to get a majority, obviously. I don't think they have the votes to over to get past a and to get things moving there in terms of that sort of thing. They don't have their two-thirds majority that they need. But I think that that doesn't mean you don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Anne?
Well, you know, I mean, this is an endless conundrum. I remember it with Vietnam, but I think it got started a lot. With Vietnam, they held off getting into the anti-war and trying to end the war until much later in the process. I think the complaints about the war, the efforts to undercut the war by withholding funding and declaring defeat and so on started so much earlier that, you know, I think that there is obviously a role for politics, but it also has to be possible to fight a war. And when people's lives are on the line, when people are fighting that war, there does need to be support for those people. And to just say, you know, don't say we're unpatriotic, don't call us traitors and so forth. You know, I think, you know, when you're not supporting people who are fighting, there has to be some argument like that.
Oh,
and anyway, let me just say one more thing, that there was a big ad in the New York Times put on by MoveOn.org calling General Petraeus a traitor. General Petraeus, General Petraeus, to call Petraeus a traitor. That was way over.
I want to talk about that. Yeah.
Let me just respond briefly to Anne's comments about supporting troops. Simply because one opposes a war because one doesn't see any logic to it, any end game to it, its worthwhileness in terms of costing American lives, doesn't mean you don't support the troops. And you know, and we can go over this time and time again. But I mean, you know, the people who have been opposing this war are not the ones who are responsible for you know, the bad policies in terms of how we're treating veterans. I mean, if we're going to measure support for those who have fought this war, let's hold people's feet to the fire in terms of accountability there.
Let me hold you both there for a moment because I'm past my break time and need to do this. We are talking with Anne Althaus and Peg Lautenschlager during this edition of The Week in Review. 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in with a thought or a question about something in the news this week. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 4, it's Your Views on the News. Ben will talk with a guest professor of political science about the news of the week this afternoon after 4 o'clock. And that's what we are doing this hour. It's our Week in Review. Today we are talking with Peg Lautenschlager, attorney with Lawton & Cates, former Attorney General of Wisconsin, and Anne Althaus, a professor of law at the UW-Madison, currently a visiting professor of law at the Brooklyn Law School. And here is General David Petraeus testifying on Monday. He testified on Monday and Tuesday before Senate and House panels.
In describing the recommendations I have made, I should note again that, like Ambassador Crocker, I believe Iraq's problems will require a long-term effort. There are no easy answers or quick solutions. And although we both believe this effort can succeed, it will take time.
Let's talk a little bit about how he was met, I think it was on Monday, with that ad in the New York Times that said that General Petraeus is lying, that he is really General Betraeus. And you say, Ann Althaus, you consider that move from MoveOn.org traitorous?
Oh, I said it was outrageous that they called him a traitor. Oh. I wasn't saying they were traitors. I mean, of course, they're using overheated rhetoric of the sort that you expect from MoveOn.org. They're not the Democratic Party. They're not anybody that's running for president. You know, I just think it's an ugly kind of rhetoric, but it's typical of MoveOn.org.
And there were calls mainly from Republicans that Democrats running for president denounce MoveOn.org.
Yeah, denounce them. That's a typical move that's used a lot these days. Something extreme is said, and then you make that central, and then you ask the more moderate people who are actually, you know, running for president to denounce the people who are to their left or to their right, and, you know.
Yeah. Should Hillary Clinton, Peg Lautenschlager, denounce MoveOn.org for that ad?
You know, I don't know that you denounce MoveOn.org for that ad, but you recognize that you don't agree with it. And I think that's essentially what needs to be done. You know, there is rhetoric on the right, there's rhetoric on the left, there's rhetoric coming from the center, too. And tragically, we've reached that day and age where, you know, the soundbite has overridden a logical thought and discussion. And I think that perhaps the bigger message there is that, you know, a quick phrase, a turn of phrase like this is something which garners more attention than a speech by Jack Reed that's far more analytical in nature. Nobody pays attention to that, but somebody does pay attention to a General Betraeus ad. And I think, you know, that's the tragedy in it. And I think perhaps the discussion ought to be around that. You know, there are, whether or not it's what my kids would call political smack, that's headed Hillary Clinton's way on a regular basis and has since she was first lady, or whether or not it's the things that are about John Edwards because he's a trial lawyer, or whether or not it's things that have been posed about Republican candidates as well. The reality is that it's these little glitchy things which seem to garner all the attention and are used very effectively, I think, to move public opinion. And tragically, that doesn't get us to a result where we get the best elected officials.
I haven't seen it because I've been locked in the studio all morning, but Rudy Giuliani, who is running for president, former New York mayor, says that he was going to buy an ad that was going to appear today, I believe, that it was in support of General Petraeus. And he was saying yesterday, anyway, that he wanted the same discount that has been reported. The New York Times the New York Times sold this ad for a discounted rate to MoveOn.org. What do you make of Rudy Giuliani getting into this fray?
Well, I think it was clever to put it that way. It puts pressure on the New York Times. There's a factual question here about whether MoveOn.org got a deep discount, like less than half price, for a big full-page ad in the New York Times. I don't know whether that happened or not. I don't know whether a comparable group in some other political position gets those rates. So there's a factual question there to be solved. But if the New York Times is giving deep discounts to things like that, obviously it makes the New York Times look bad. And Rudy Giuliani is doing well to put a little pressure on them because, in fact, they do support the liberal candidates. And, you know, I think drawing out those biases is important to do, but we need to find out what the facts are on what happened with that purported discount. I don't know.
Any comment on that, Peg?
Well, other than I haven't seen the New York Times. I haven't seen the New York Times endorse Dennis Kucinich yet, Ann, and I think he's probably the only true liberal left in the race.
Let's go to the phones again. Ned in Wausau is with us next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the primary thing that we're talking about in the Iraq War is the blame game and who lost the Iraq War, because no matter who is the president and no matter who makes the decisions, there is no way to win this war. And first of all, the definition of success, which was used many times by President Bush last night in his speech, he kept saying success, success, over and over again. The definition of success should be a stable government in Iraq that can stand on its own and does not need the green zone in order for it to operate, and obviously a military and a police force that can keep the country stable. I don't think within a decade there is even one chance in a million of that ever happening. So since the odds are so strongly against that occurring, I think the key thing is, who is going to get blamed with the loss of this war? And we will lose it no matter what, unless we water down the definition of success to the extreme that President Bush has done so. So anyway, we've diverted resources from where they should be going, hunting down Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, probably. We've killed 3,700 people, and we've spent over about $500 billion. Now we are finding that children's health care, there's no funding for it, and the reason there isn't is Iraq war.
Okay, too much to chew on with that comment. let me ask you, Ann Althaus, first. Do you have a clear idea what success is in Iraq, according to President Bush?
Well, I mean, I don't think we should get into an all or nothing position where we think we must have victory or we ought to just admit defeat and walk away. Because I think defining something as some sort of success and trying to preserve American interests is very important. To just openly call things defeat is going to have repercussions. It's going to cause other things to go wrong elsewhere. So I think Bush is doing right to hold it together, to try to define something that is within the level of what's pragmatically possible to do, and to try to make the best of it. And it's true, as the caller said, that it's not going to end when Bush is out of office. And Bush is kind of trying to structure things so that he can get to the end of his term without things going too bad. And the next president is going to have to deal with it. So, we're going to have to get past the phase when the people who are running for president are just criticizing Bush, because Bush is going to find a way to survive to the end of his presidency, and the next president really is going to have to deal with it. So the question is, who's going to deal with it the best? And I think just having a defeatist, negative attitude that gives up is completely impractical, despite the caller's efforts at saying what the odds are. It's a one in a million. I mean, thing is that there has to be something that's better than, we need to try to get into the best position there. And the fact that we can't have exactly what we want is irrelevant. We have to deal with the real world.
Well, whatever success is, the president said that the success of a free Iraq is critical to the security of the United States. It will deny al-Qaeda a safe haven and will counter what he calls the destructive ambitions of Iran. So what about that, Peg Lautenschlager?
Well, getting back to that, I don't agree. Let's start with that. But secondly, getting back to this whole notion of kind of what do we call success, from my perspective, you've got you have a president who has used this speech, first of all, to pass off this war to the next president. He's going to be in a holding pattern between now and the end of his tenure in office, and whoever gets it next will be the one they can blame for it not being a success. And the notion of having this sort of moving definition of success allows those who got involved in Iraq in the first place to be able to say to Bush's successors, especially if it's somebody of a different party, oh, this is not success. You have afforded, you have caused us to be defeated in Iraq. Or because of this moving target of success, they can say, if it's somebody who they like, oh, yes, we will call this success, depending on who that office holder is. Then the other issue I have is with this sort of domino theory thing. If we, if Iraq falls, next Iran takes over the area, and then we have this and that, and before you know it, al-Qaeda is everywhere. We heard that logic in Vietnam, and in terms of, if we have the spread of communism, communism fell on its own accord, I think, as time went on. But we've got to be realistic here about what we would like to accomplish, define that, have it be a realistic goal. I mean, I think one of the real tragedies in this administration is its need for having a centralized government, which I think is a reflection on its desire to be able to control oil commodities in that area. Indeed, I think a loose federation of the various tribes and groups which control the region might be far more manageable and far more doable.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about Osama bin Laden, since Ned brought up that he thought this war has distracted in the hunt for Osama bin Laden. We did see Osama bin Laden on a videotape released for the anniversary of 9/11. He looked different. He had a darker beard.
He's got the new look.
Yeah. But he reminded us all that, you know, he is still out there.
He's out there, but he's kind of in a box. He hasn't been able to do that much. His videos, he seemed a little out of it, kind of raving. Some people were saying he was raving sort of like lefty talking points, talking about Noam Chomsky and then weird things like mortgages and too much taxes. It was like a mishmash of American issues. It seems like a sort of he'd be a sort of doddering, raving old man if we weren't also afraid of him. He's a bit of a clown. And then he also had a second video that he put out telling, the young men of Islam to join the caravan of martyrdom. In other words, he's like a Jim Jones character saying, wouldn't it be great to die? We're afraid of the guy, but at the same time, he's been ineffectual. He seems to be sort of out of touch. And the idea that if only we could kill him, things would be better. Well, if we killed him, there would be someone else who would take his place. Maybe we're better off with this sort of clownish, incapacitated, beard-changing man in a cave.
What do you think, Peg Lautenschlager?
I don't know. I'm a woman of an age where a bottle of hair dye has done me some good, so I'm not going to criticize Osama on that, but Bin Laden on that. But let me just say that, you know, I think the real tragedy to the Bin Laden thing is the way in which we've been unable to define ourselves there as well. When it's convenient, we discuss him and the terror which has resulted because of his actions and this need to kind of come together and fight Iraq and whoever else we're going to be needing to fight in order to ensure that terrorism no longer hits the United States. While at the same time, we trivialize his meaningfulness when it's convenient. We ought to be deciding whether or not we want to try to eliminate Osama bin Laden, and if we do, let's make an effort to do it, or else say as Anne did today, you know, that this guy's existence is rather meaningless at this point, and that we might as well just focus on the real issues involving terrorism. But let's make a decision on that and do it and get rid of the fixation on the guy.
My point is that that terrorism matters and we need to fight terrorism, but the fixation on the one particular individual might be not necessary, since there will be other individuals. It's not as if Al-Qaeda is a movement that's entirely about one man as opposed to many people. So it may actually it may not be that important to kill this one man, although of course it would be exciting for us to have, you know, to have his head, but we don't, that's not necessarily, that's not the highest.
Well, and I think
and simply killing him isn't going to end terrorism.
And I think I take your argument one step further, Anne, and say that, you know, and Al-Qaeda is not an organization which has infiltrated just one or two countries as well. It's an organization which has a worldwide presence, and where we look in terms of that or how we decide to manage that as a nation is something that ought to be discussed in a more rational form, too.
I wonder what your thoughts are, both of you, on the anniversary of 9/11, the six-year anniversary, and the talk that we have not been struck by another terrorist attack in those 6 years, and what that tells you, Anne Althaus.
Well, you know, I'm living in Brooklyn. I have I'm living in an apartment that looks out on Lower Manhattan. So I was seeing the memorial lights. You know, they have these two towers of light that that represent the destroyed towers. And, you know, and yet, you know, life goes on. There were fewer people at the ceremonies this year. It's been 6 years. At the same time, I think people have gone back to normal. I mean, people show the respect when the day comes up. We notice, we say various things in recognition of it. But I think at the same time, we've come to feel sort of safe, and it's become sort of an abstraction that we care about, but we're not, I don't think we're fearful. I don't think we're fretting about it. But some of that may be complacency just because nothing has happened. And whether anybody wants to give the Bush administration credit for the fact that nothing has happened, I know that the automatic answer is, well, Al-Qaeda's on a long timeline, so they're just biding their time. They never do things, another thing, that quickly. But the fact is, it's been 6 years. There have been a lot of plots that have been interrupted. So I assume that there are things going on and that we have a line on Al-Qaeda that is somewhat effective.
Mm-hmm. Peg Lautenschlager?
Well, I think to put a political spin on it is nonsense. To me, if you look at terrorism, you never know when it's going to happen. And the fact that whenever you have people who are willing to give their own lives in order to commit a terrorist act, it's hard to control. I mean, we've seen that in countries like Israel, where security is some of the highest in the world. I had a trip to Israel a year and a half ago, and you know, getting through the airport, even to get on a plane to get to Israel, is a security lesson in and of itself. There are guards throughout Jerusalem, morning, noon, and night, and the like. And yet, you have terrorist bombers who commit acts of terrorism with regularity, which gets to, I think, the notion that the ultimate solution to terrorism problems lies not within increased security and arming oneself to the hilt, but rather to look at you know, logical kinds of ways in which you can reach accords with different groups or take military action. That being said, the 9/11 situation is one which certainly is very tragic, and certainly one which I think we're all going to remember. But I think Mayor Bloomberg probably was most articulate in discussing sort of the need to always remember and yet move on in life as sort of a dedication in dedication to and in recognition of those victims. And I think he was very articulate in expressing those thoughts this year.
Okay, break time and probably enough talk about war and terrorism. Let's talk about some other issues in the news this week after we return from this short break. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Peg Lautenschlager, attorney with Lawton & Cates, former Attorney General of Wisconsin, and Ann Althaus, professor of law at UW-Madison, currently a visiting professor at Brooklyn Law School. She's also got a popular web spot or a blog, althaus.blogspot.com. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our numbers, if you'd like to join in with an issue from the news this week. We're going to talk about a couple of national issues from the presidential campaign trail and some state issues, including the budget stalemate. Or is there a break in that stalemate in sight? We'll talk about that as well coming up in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen's guest will talk about the upcoming Making Democracy Work Summit, sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. After 10, Kathleen and her guest will discuss The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and the view that it effectively and entertainingly conveys real messages through fake news. We're talking about the real news during this Friday Week in Review with our two guests, Ann Althaus and Peg Lautenschlager. I wanted to talk about Oprah Winfrey having a big fundraiser for Barack Obama. And I don't know if she's officially endorsed him, but presumably if you're holding a fundraiser
for... She supports him.
Anyhow, I mean...
She'll support the alternative Democrat if it's not Obama, but she is supporting him and helping him raise funds.
Yeah. Well, is that a big deal, Peg Lautenschlager, or not?
Well, it is a big deal. You know, in the race for president on the Democratic side, you know, things have taken a turn to focus on money, probably starting with Bill Clinton, when Democrats realized that with Republican expenditures as they are, that they had to focus on money raising. You know, and the Clintons, frankly, took it to new levels in ways which I would argue have compromised Democrats on occasion. Obama's getting Oprah Winfrey's support obviously affords him the opportunity to continue with this fundraising high on which he's been for quite a while, while at the same time appealing to more average voters and affording him the opportunity not to have to rely on kind of special interest money givers, as has historically been seen by those who raise money on either side of the political aisle.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think Oprah is really influential, and she's such a great speaker, better than he is, I think, and he's great. But what I don't like about what I'm seeing here is that she's totally supporting him on the basis of his message of hope. And of course, he's been relying on this message of hope and the audacity of hope for the longest time. I think for him to be successful, he needs to get beyond that. He's gotten as far as he can get, I think, on just saying hope and being too abstract. And now she is perpetuating this this hope message. I'm afraid he's kind of on a path to irrelevance unless he can say things that are much more about the role of being president and less about just generically inspiring people, if he's going to be any kind of a match for Hillary Clinton, who's getting way out ahead of him.
Well, I think he's a guy who's obviously very articulate, very bright, very achieved both academically in his profession and as a public servant. And I think that that message is developing. You know, it's interesting to me because we have a variety of kids in our family. There are five of them. I think every one of them has a different favorite presidential candidate. But the one who's for Obama is a 26-year-old lawyer who's been successful in his own right in his first 26 years. And that message has really caught on with him. And I think for kids of that younger generation, of course, I'll admit to you, a lot of them don't vote, hearing somebody define something positive at the end of their lifetime is very encouraging for them, because I think they've grown up in this age where we've talked about the collapse of Social Security, we've talked about too many people, what are we going to do with baby boomers as we all get old, whatever else. And to think that there's somebody there who's speaking in positive terms and positive ways and not just kowtowing to political special interests, whose transparency and mission seems to be quite up front, is, I think, for them, something that's refreshing.
So and the implication there is that Hillary Clinton is not inspiring, does not have a message of hope, and that he's the antithesis.
Oh, I think she certainly does. I think, though, you know, Hillary, what makes Hillary the 800-pound gorilla, though, in the race, I think is also going to be what causes her to have some folks in the Democratic side, at least, who have concerns, which is her incredible fundraising ability and her ability to raise monies not just from those who are traditional Democrats, but also from those who kind of play the political game and get folks on both sides of the aisle.
John Edwards was in Wisconsin this week on Monday in Milwaukee, and some of the news that came out of that appearance is that the Democratic Party chair in Wisconsin endorsed him. Joe Winicky endorsed him personally, not speaking for the Democratic Party, but just as an individual. Is that okay, Peg Lautenschlager?
I think it's absolutely fine. You know, this notion that Democratic Party chairs shouldn't pick a favorite or this and that is all sort of a myth anyway. You know, everybody has their favorite. I always chuckled when the League of Women Voters would have forums and say, you know, this is totally nonpartisan. I don't think there's such a thing in the world as totally nonpartisan, whether it's a Supreme Court justices, League of Women Voter members, or chairs of political parties. I think, you know, we all have our ideas. That's why we're involved in the political process. And I think I'd rather have transparency and have people upfront about what they think or do rather than to go through this pretend game of saying, you know, oh, I can't make a formal endorsement, and yet every action that they take, you know, implies an endorsement of one person or another. Just be upfront and take your hits for that, you know, for that endorsement, and take your applause for that endorsement. You know, in Joe's defense, and Joe and I have known each other for years, and there are times I've agreed with him, and many times when I haven't as well. You know, John Edwards has articulated a message that Democrats ordinarily have articulated. He has talked about issues like poverty. He's talked about issues like income disparity. He's talked about issues like health care and education, and gets to sort of the base and core of what makes the Democratic Party the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me when you have a leadership role representing a diverse group of people that being a little circumspect about your personal preferences in this situation would be the better path. So I don't think it's good.
Yeah, let's just touch on the Republican side of the race a little bit. Fred Thompson formally entered last week, but has he changed the dynamic, Ann Althaus?
Well, I mean, I've been blocking about this idea of, is he lackluster? Is it a fizzle? You know, he was being coy. He stayed at it for the longest time. And then when he finally got in, you would have thought he would be ready. He would hit the ground running. He'd make a big splash. So I think it's sort of like, what, this guy isn't ready for prime time? What's really going on? But then I also have this idea that maybe he totally knows what he's doing, that that thing of staying out worked really well for him. And then when he got in, he didn't just start announcing all sorts of policies and doing all sorts of things. He was just there being Fred, being not McCain, not Giuliani, not Romney, not all these other people that we don't quite think are good enough. So I think he actually has a strategy of just being inspiring confidence and being the alternative to all of these other people who all seem to have problems. So I kind of think he's doing it deliberately, but he's also been attacked. There was an interesting column by Robert Novak yesterday about how blaming Mary Madeline, actually, for turning away lots of people who were trying to come together and help him, and that they were basically being, you know, cocooned and not not responding, not putting together a vivid, active campaign. So maybe that's a criticism. Maybe he just isn't ready to be a candidate. But I think maybe there are some smart people who figured out that this is actually working for him. He's gotten a long way, and he needs to find a way to be the candidate and actually keep doing the same sort of thing that made him so popular when he wasn't a candidate.
Well, you know, I find that interesting, Anne, because you've just told us that Obama hasn't told us who he is or what he stands for, and now you've been, and because of that, he's made himself irrelevant. And yet, you're telling me now that Fred Thompson is not being a whole bunch of people, and
right,
by doing that, suddenly becomes the man of the hour.
Right.
I'm not quite sure if you can have it both ways.
Here's how I can have it both ways. Here's the distinction. I think that that strategy can work, but it only works up to a point. In Obama's case, he's got this incredibly strong, virtually inevitable front runner, Hillary Clinton. He's got to have something to fight off her. Whereas on the Republican side, you have more of a group of people who all aren't quite good enough. There's, you know, I don't think Rudy Giuliani is in the same category as Hillary Clinton. I think, you know, there's so many flaws with him that it's sort of weird. Why is he the front runner? Why are Republicans accepting him? It's actually quite bizarre. It's not equivalent to the front runner position that Hillary Clinton has. So I think the strategy can work on the Republican side in a way that it can't work. If there was no Hillary Clinton, Obama could be the front runner.
And I want the copy of the transcript on the part where we have a bunch of Republican candidates who don't quite make it. Is that what the term was?
No. Let me.
I think they all have flaws. You know, you look at Giuliani and Romney and McCain. People have problems with all of them. And I think that the strangest thing is that Giuliani is the front runner. Look at all of his problems.
We need to.
But, you know, and I think that gets to a broader discussion, too, that has to do with the way in which American media works today, whether or not we haven't totally focused on flaws of various individuals as opposed to looking at what they bring to the table and their strengths. Tragically, we've gone that direction.
We do need to move on since we're running short on time this hour, and we haven't talked about the state budget, which isn't going anywhere, or maybe it is. It says here a conference committee working on the stalled state budget plans to meet again today. Does this show some progress in resolving the stalemate? The assembly plans to meet next week, Tuesday, and pass a separate education budget. The governor says he won't accept that, and you shouldn't be passing the budget piecemeal. What do you say, Pegalonzo?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, it tragically, if we want to talk about the politicization of something where it probably matters, our state budget tragically has been impacted by that. You have a Republican assembly that has, for no other reasons than media value, put provisions in there that are absolutely ludicrous. My favorite, of course, is the elimination of the law school at Wisconsin. And maybe you'll have to stay in New York. But, this sort of point-making is sad. You've got the state Senate where Democrats came together, work hard, and actually produced a health care plan for this state. You may like it or you may not, but, you know, kudos to them for finally coming up with something that they put on paper and are able to manage to get through their house. And then you've got a governor who's got the strongest veto pen of any governor in America, and who somehow fails to be exercising leadership when it comes to the health care plan education, UW system, the list goes on, and we sit at stalemate. And while we sit at stalemate, the only it inures to the benefit of only one group of people, and that is politicians raising money. As you know, more and more monies come into campaign coffers by the various interests that want a piece of that budget. I think it's politics at its worst. I think this is not only something which it talks about. This not only illustrates a need for a change in the system itself, perhaps, but I think it better, even more importantly, illustrates a need for transparency in government and campaign finance reform.
Why, Peg, you criticized the Democrat, so you blame Doyle.
I blame Doyle and the Assembly Republicans. I think the Assembly Republicans were nonsensical in some of the programs they put forward. And, you know, and if you start with a bargaining position way out, you know, in Pluto, which apparently is no longer part of our galaxy, it's hard to come back in. And then I think, but so at that point, you need to exercise some leadership, and I think that's where the governor comes in.
Well, I read in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel an editorial, I think it was on Monday, saying that, yes, the governor should exert some leadership, but what they were suggesting is to convince Judy Robson, the Senate Democratic leader, to drop Healthy Wisconsin, and then maybe that would release the logjam. Peg?
Well, there are a lot of funders. There are a lot of people who buy ads and help fund the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who are opposed to it. So that's probably why the Milwaukee Journal is opining in such a manner.
Yeah. What's your take, Ann, on the budget stalemate and this separate budget?
Well, it seems like it's an effort to make some kind of a compromise. On the other hand, it also seems like a stunt, and it isn't likely to work. So, you know, maybe the Republicans can get some good press out of that, but it's not really very inspiring. I'm not inspired by either party. I'm just looking on and shaking my head, and I guess like a lot of other people in Wisconsin.
Let me take
one. I wish they'd get together somehow.
Dennis and Beloit, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, regarding the topic of the budget and this logjam, whether one be a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent, I think we're all very disappointed. What happened to the idea that politicians work for the people and get together and dialogue? To use health care as an example, if people don't agree or particular politicians don't agree with Healthy Wisconsin, and I realize it has significant funding challenges, why not bring your plan to the table or dialogue, for heaven's sakes? This is imbecilic behavior, and it's unacceptable to me. That's my comment.
I'm with you, Dennis, and my biggest concern is as you watch government and how it's worked these days, everything's about money now. Everything's about how much money will it bring. Who, if I take a position on this bill, who's going to oppose me and how much money can they give to my opponent? For us to pretend that the world in state capitol domes throughout America or in the Congress are any different would be at best naive.
Yeah. Any further comment on that, Ann?
No, I like the use of the word imbecilic. That's a caller that expressed some of our frustration.
Well, I know that, Ann Althaus, you have to run to get to a meeting, so we will wrap it up since we're at the end of the hour. Thank you very much for
thank
being
you.
With us. And Peg Lautenschlager, thank you very much for being with us as well.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Yes, Peg Lautenschlager is a attorney now with Lawton and Cates, a law firm, former Attorney General of Wisconsin, Ann Althaus, a professor of law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, currently a visiting professor of law at Brooklyn Law School. You can check out her writings at her website, althaus.blogspot.com. Thanks to both of them for being with us. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. If you would like to purchase a CD of this or any of our talk shows, call the radio store 1-800-747-7444. You can also listen to all of our talk shows archived on our website. You can listen through your computer at your convenience, wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.